From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudette. This is Idaho Matters, and it's Friday, which means it's time for our reporter roundtable. We're going to get you up to date on the news that made headlines this week around our region. And today, our panel includes Caitlin Hart with EastIdahoNews.com, Carly Flandreau, reporter with Idaho Ed News, Will Walkey, reporter for the Mountain West News Bureau, as well as Wyoming Public Media, Ian Max Stevenson with the Idaho Statesman, and Logan Finney with Idaho Reports on Idaho Public Television. Hi, everybody.
Thanks for having us.
Hello.
So, Logan, I want to start the conversation with you, and I want to begin with the Idaho GOP and a restraining order that is blocking them from electing new leaders. So can we start this conversation by you just taking us back to how and when all of this started and why?
Sure thing. This news broke about exactly a week ago now. And this is a situation over in Bingham County, which is the Blackfoot area in eastern Idaho between Pocatello and Idaho Falls. And this has to do with kind of an insidery baseball political issue where your listeners may be familiar or may not be familiar with county central committees. So every political party has, so the Republicans have a central committee, the Democrats have a central committee, and these local committees are made up of precinct committee people. So every voting precinct, so the place that you go to vote on election day, each party gets to pick a representative from that neighborhood, basically. And those committees are very, very important. They do things like endorsements and fundraising. And more recently, they now have the power to censure elected officials if they feel they've been straying from the party platform. And so where this all started was over the summer, back in July, the Bingham County Republican chairman, Dan Cravens, announced that he was going to resign effective August 1st. And so basically what happens is the state party says that the Bingham County Republicans did not go through the proper methods, and there's allegations that they broke the party rules and bylaws when they elected their new officers. And so the state party intended to, on Monday of this week, hold a new election to how they said to elect officers following the rules properly. And the Bingham County Republicans objected to that and tried to file an appeal with the party. And the state party was going to go ahead with this election of new officers. And so a lawsuit was filed last Friday to stop the meeting that was supposed to happen on Monday. And I'll stop there so we can reorient.
Okay. So from this point, we're at last week. So what is happening in this case right now? Because they cannot elect folks for these positions, correct?
Right. Yes. So the issue comes down to the old chairman Cravens had announced he was going to resign. And so under the party rules, once the chairman resigns, then the first vice chairman acts as the chairman and calls a meeting to elect new officers. What happened in this instance is that the county committee held their elections before the resignation officially took place. And so there are concerns that the meeting wasn't properly noticed. When I went through and read through the court documents, the meeting was, or the notice that they were going to elect new officers at this July meeting was sent out to the precinct committee people who were going to be attending the meeting. And so then there were complaints from other folks that it should have been more widely publicized if people wanted to attend this meeting in July and perhaps run for these offices. And so it's kind of tricky to untangle all of it, but basically the party says, well, they're both of the parties. So the state party says the county party broke rules, and the county party says the state party broke rules in trying to fix the issue. So the restraining order blocks the state party from holding new leadership elections for the county party until this appeals process goes through. And so the Republican Executive Committee, so that's made up of the state officers for the party, their regular meeting is tomorrow on Saturday, and they will hear this appeal from the county party over whether Idaho Republican Party Chairwoman Dorothy Moon overstepped or improperly called this new meeting.
Okay, so we just basically have to wait and see what then happens at this meeting tomorrow to find out what happens after that.
Basically, yeah. They've so this lawsuit, there is a court date that is next Thursday. And this restraining order is, it's what's called a temporary restraining order. This is kind of an unusual step for a court to take. And it was taken because the lawsuit was filed last Friday to attempt to block a meeting that was scheduled for Monday. So a very short turnaround. And so the judge acknowledged that, hey, Dorothy Moon and the state party haven't had an opportunity to respond to these allegations. So we're just going to put a pause on this meeting, at least until the appeal from the Bingham County party can make its way through the internal party appeals process. So there's a very good likelihood that this could all be addressed on Saturday. And when the two sides show up in court on Thursday, they could say, hey, we sorted this out, judge, everything's fine. Or alternatively, you know, who knows what's going to happen on Saturday. The Republican Party is a private organization, so that is not a public meeting. So I will certainly be paying attention to what happens in the Bingham County Court next week.
Okay. And a member of the Boise School Board was arrested in New York City earlier this week. Tell us about this.
Yeah, so 19-year-old Shiva Rajbandari, who, as you said, is a member of the Boise School Board, is also a prominent climate change activist in the area, was arrested on Monday as part of a series of demonstrations in New York, calling on U.S. and global leaders to rapidly curb the amount of emissions that countries produce and transition to clean energy. There was a climate summit held in New York this week, and there were tens of thousands of demonstrators there. And Shiva was one of those, and he was in a group in the financial district of about 150 people who were arrested. And he was held in police custody for several hours on Monday and then released. And he told me that he'd never been arrested before, but that the kind of traditional rules of trying to do demonstrations haven't been working, and that he wants the government to act faster.
So is he, and he's going to school in North Carolina right now, correct, Ian?
Yes. He just started as a freshman at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
So at this point, he is, I'm assuming, back at school and will remain on the school board until further notice.
Yes. He said that he plans to finish his term. It was a 2-year term he was elected to last fall. He plans to finish his term remotely while attending college.
Okay. All right. Appreciate that update. So Carly, keeping with school district boards, a Teton County school board trustee has apparently been censured. What's happening there, and how did we get to this point?
Yeah. So in Teton County, trustee Kathleen Haar had made a post on Facebook, and it was putting into question some hiring practices of the district of 10 employees, which she listed by name. And the teachers really took that as a personal attack. The superintendent said that it really crushed morale there for the first 2 weeks, and administrators throughout the district had to work in their buildings to kind of bring their community back together. And so Haar was censured in a number of ways. All of the administrators in the district wrote a letter saying why her actions were inappropriate in their opinion. They read that at a board meeting. The board chair penned an op-ed in the local paper. And Kathleen Haar, for her part, she said she was just trying to explain some public records rules and that community members had a right to know who were considered for a given position. So anyway, that's what's been going on there. And it's interesting and of note because lately school board trustee elections have become more competitive and politicized. Mm-hmm. And as that's happened, we've seen more and more censures. Like in April, Shiva Rajbandari, that we were just talking about, he was similarly rebuked by his board chair for a social media post in which he swore at and threatened Governor Brad Little. And then earlier this month, two West Bonner trustees were recalled by voters after a controversial decision to hire Brandon Durst as superintendent. So the Teton County is just kind of the latest in a string of censuring those public officials.
Yeah, you make some good points with, I mean, I think all the turmoil that's going on with so many of these school districts. Caitlin, the former Jefferson County prosecutor is now facing federal drug charges. Can you start out by giving us the backstory on this?
Yes. So Robin Dunn was arrested here in Bonneville County in Idaho Falls in February. And he was charged with felony possession of a controlled substance and then two misdemeanor counts for possessing a controlled substance. And what we know from police reports so far is that the Idaho Falls Police Department was called to a restaurant parking lot in Idaho Falls around 8:45 after someone called in and said that there was a woman in the parking lot in the driver's seat of a car who appeared to be under the influence and unsafe to drive. So police got there and they found this woman, Vivian Exler, and Robin Dunn in the car. They asked them what they were doing, and they said that Robin Dunn was her attorney and that they were going over evidence. They later found about 60 fentanyl pills in the car. They also found Xanax pills and alprazolam pills, which are both controlled substances. They also found in the car a check made out to the woman from Robin Dunn for a total of $7,900. And they also found a bottle of Narcan in Dunn's pocket. So after that happened, Dunn was arrested and he was booked into the Bonneville County Jail, eventually bonded out, and was just charged with these local charges. So then this week, it came out that a grand jury had indicted Dunn on federal drug charges. So now he is charged with one federal count of conspiracy to distribute fentanyl and methamphetamine, two counts of possession with the intent to distribute fentanyl and methamphetamine, and one count of distribution of methamphetamine, which also means that this week the local charges got dropped. And we also learned that Robin Dunn was arrested in his house in Rigby and was taken to Cache County out in Burley, about 2 hours from Idaho Falls, because he was the Jefferson County prosecutor. So I think they probably didn't want to house him there, to keep him there. So he was taken all the way to Burley for that. As of, I believe, 2 days ago, he was still in jail. I'll need to check today to see if he's still there. But yeah, he was the Jefferson County prosecutor for 34 years. He was also the city attorney for Roberts and Ryrie up until this happened. They let him go in March 2023. And he was also the Rigby city attorney for almost 30 years. So it's a quickly developing story.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, I would assume with having been in office for that long, well regarded in those communities. So pretty shocking when something like this happens, in particular, I think in these smaller, you know, counties and towns.
Right. These aren't very big cities. I mean, it's been kind of surprising to hear the feedback from this, because a lot of people are surprised, and it seems like a lot of people may have heard rumblings about this. And so it'll be interesting to see what happens. They're still scheduling court dates for the federal side of things. So we, at this point, are just waiting to see what happens.
Okay. Thanks for that update. Will, you recently did a really interesting story about long haul truck drivers, and you brought up something that I think probably a lot of people don't think about, and this is parking spaces. Can you talk about why this is an issue, and what's being done to hopefully remedy this problem that maybe many of us just have not even considered?
Yeah, I want to give you a quick peek behind the curtain first. The State Transportation Department of Wyoming gave me a pitch earlier this month that was like, hey, Will, come check out this new parking lot we built. It's in the middle of nowhere in Wyoming. It's on the side of the highway on a windy stretch of barren road. Don't you want to come see it? And like you said, I was like, well, maybe I have something better to do, but let me look into this and read more about the problem of trucker space. And yeah, it's a huge one. I mean, I think most people know how important trucks are to the economy. In fact, about 3/4 of all U.S. freight is brought at some point by truck. So they're just absolutely massive for all the goods and services that we enjoy. But truckers like you and me, they need places to eat. They need places to sleep. They need places to wait out winter storms, which, you know, unfortunately are coming up, especially in the high country of the Mountain West, all too soon. And so I learned that there is just a huge lack of places for them to do that and park their car in a safe spot. So often they're on the side of the road, they're in a dangerous area, they're in the middle of nowhere, a town where they can't get services. In fact, for every one parking space that is safe on our interstate system, there are 11 truckers. So just a massive lack of space. And so how do we fix that? Well, we just build more parking lots one at a time. And so federal transportation departments, state transportation departments, local transportation departments across the country are looking for space and places to build. And especially on important interstates like Interstate 80 through Wyoming, Interstate 84 through Idaho, we need more spots. So a lot of federal grant money is going towards that right now.
Mm-hmm. And Will, did you talk with some truck drivers and about how this impacts them? Because I mean, and frankly, I think there could potentially be a safety issue here, right? When you don't have enough parking spots and these truck drivers cannot pull over, they could be tired, right? I mean, and we know about drowsy driving, and I would assume that this could potentially be an issue if they don't have a safe space to pull over.
For sure, because what does it mean when you can't find a nice parking place, you know, with a bathroom? It means that you're usually just pulling over on the shoulder on a highway. And I think most of us that have driven long distances across the Mountain West have had that experience where you're driving over a ridge, you quickly come upon a driver who's maybe set up a couple of flags, but they're stepping out of their cab and you have to swerve to avoid them. I mean, yeah, when there aren't safe parking spaces, truckers are still going to stop. And so that just makes our roadways more dangerous, especially for these truck drivers who, as I said, they're so vital for the American economy. And we don't think about them until our goods don't show up at the store the day that we need it.
Yeah, exactly. So at this point, Will, we know about this big parking lot in Wyoming that you talked about. What's the federal government planning next? Just more parking lots along certain, I would assume, busy interstates and roadways?
Sure. It's one of those stories that your listeners have probably heard a lot about, the bipartisan infrastructure law, the Inflation Reduction Act, these huge federal spending packages that the Biden administration passed. They're putting about $1.2 trillion towards infrastructure, just kind of mind-boggling numbers here. Not all of that's going to go to parking, but you know, the Federal Highway Administrator was there in Wyoming on that barren stretch of highway with me, and he just talked about, you know, for those that drive across the interstates a lot, like reporters that are on this call, hopefully they're going to be seeing more and more of these parking lots get built in the next few years.
Okay, so Will, I want to continue with this theme, but let's talk electric vehicles and trucking. So, I mean, studies have shown that when we talk about those long haul truck drivers, right? That there is these big rigs can contribute to global warming. But are we looking at, is the federal government looking at, you know, mandating that these trucks go electric at some point? Is this even something that is a possibility?
Sure. It's such an interesting topic. And I got to talk to a few truckers about this. Just a quick fact, you know, transportation, huge cause of our emissions. You know, medium and heavy duty trucks, these long haul trucks you see on the interstates, they're just 5% of the vehicles on the road. They're responsible for more than 20% of transportation emissions. So you mentioned mandates. There are a couple states, California being one of them, that is really trying to push electric long haul fleets, trying to through mandates. But a lot of this is going to be coming through private investment and through, again, huge federal grant money. There's a few electric trucks on the road. For instance, Tesla has created an electric semi that they say has about a 500-mile range. But, you know, there is a long way to go technologically and just in terms of infrastructure. Like on the side of the road that the truck stop I went to in Wyoming, there were zero electric truck chargers. So we have a long way to go, but we're certainly on that road, which I think is interesting.
Well, I think it is too, because as you were saying, like, oh, it can go up, you know, these ones from Tesla can go up to 500 miles. Well, that's not that far when, let's say, I know you interviewed someone for this story, a trucker who was going from Portland, Oregon to Eastern Virginia. So not only is it, you know, I mean, that's 500 miles doesn't cover much, but if you don't have those spots where you can recharge your vehicle, I mean, it seems like it's a good idea in theory. But as you said, it's also an infrastructure issue at this point.
Yeah, absolutely. And one other thing to add is beyond just the 500 mile range, which yet doesn't even come close to diesel right now. You know, also it takes about 15 minutes to fill up your diesel big rig. There are some fast chargers out there, so I don't want to completely generalize, but for a lot of these charging stations that are on the interstate, again, on that route from coast to coast, it could take up to 8 hours to charge your vehicle. So you just think about the big gap that's there. Again, this is going to take a lot of federal investment, and I think that folks are willing to do it because there really is so much incentives in terms of our climate to electrify long-haul vehicles, but we're kind of on a decades-long timeline here for right now.
Yeah, sounds like it. So, Carly, let's talk about teachers in particular, how we've seen just so much staff turnover. And this is something that we've seen nationally and locally. But talk to us about what leaders in the Bonneville School District are doing to maybe try at least to slow down this tremendous turnover.
Yeah, so the Bonneville School District is in the Idaho Falls area. And in the last school year, their staff turnover was higher than it's been in more than a decade. And they've seen that turnover continue to climb since the pandemic. So in Bonneville and in Idaho in general, the number one reason that teachers check for why they're leaving the classroom is personal reasons. And that's pretty vague and doesn't give us a lot of information. And so the Bonneville School District this year is wanting to kind of dig into that a little bit more and do things like staff satisfaction surveys and exit interviews and have principals who work more closely with teachers try to kind of tell them why they think that these individuals are leaving not only the district, but also education in general. And I should add that it's not just teachers that they're seeing increased turnover with. They're also seeing that with classified staff. And that includes individuals like cooks, bus drivers, custodians, that kind of thing. So the Bonneville School District, to help retain and hire classified staff, they were able to increase the wages from about $10.50 an hour, I believe it was, to about $14.50. So there was a $4 increase, which helps. But even so, the district still can't compete with the private sector. So they're kind of in a tough spot with a limited budget.
Well, and I thought it was interesting in your article, Carly, how you talked about what Heath Jackson, he's the district's executive director of planning and personnel, said at a board meeting. And this was about how we also have just a lot of the boomer generation, right, aging out, hitting retirement. But there's this issue of, okay, then how do you, have you prepared? Have you trained enough teachers to fill that gap? And that's probably an issue we're seeing across the board, not just in this school district, I would think.
Yeah, exactly. There's more and more retirements every year. And looking forward, he's saying, hey, this is going to be a real problem because it doesn't seem like we're getting as many teachers into the field as are leaving it. So there's definitely concern with that. And the bottom line is that it impacts students' education when there's constantly turnover, when teachers are more often inexperienced. Districts have to keep investing in training those individuals. So yeah, he said this is something that could become a real big issue down the line if we don't do something to address it now. So right now they're just kind of in the exploratory phase saying, hey, what can we do? And they're also seeing that employees in their district are leaving for other districts with a four-day week. And throughout Idaho, we've seen more and more districts move to that four-day week. But the impacts that that has on education, you know, that's a big question. Is it good for students to be in school just 4 days instead of five? But again, they've got to have teachers. And if that's what it takes to attract them, some districts are making that move.
Will, can we talk a little bit about this story that you recently wrote about? And this has to do with Indigenous boarding school, Native American boarding schools, to be accurate. So I want to start by just talking about the fact that there's been a lot of work done lately around and bringing this to light about these boarding schools in the U.S. and Canada that really traumatized Indigenous children. But what's happened now in regards to figuring out just how many of these institutions there were?
Yeah, thanks for the opportunity to talk about this. As you said, this is a hard history that, frankly, we're still learning more and more about every day. And the federal government has done some really good work in the last couple of years compiling data around these Native American boarding schools. And for those that don't know, the policy around these schools was to essentially erase Indigenous culture from children, right? Their hair was cut, they're punished for speaking their language or practicing their culture. Really traumatizing stuff that went on for decades from the 1800s to the middle of the last century. And so some of these schools were ran and administered by the federal government. Some of them were not. And so this coalition focused on healing from the trauma of these boarding school institutions, they recently kind of expanded their parameters and added a bunch of schools. And what these schools were, they weren't ran by the federal government. They were often ran by churches, usually Christian missionaries. And although they weren't receiving federal funding, they had the exact same goals, which again was to erase Indigenous culture from children. And so through this most recent, I guess you could call it expanded parameters, they were able to create a new map to kind of update the number to now over 500 schools, where before it was around 400. And these schools were across the country, and they were in Idaho as well. A lot of them, as I said, were Christian missionaries near Indigenous reservations. So there were some in eastern Idaho around the Shoshone-Bannock tribe. There were some up around Nez Perce land near the Panhandle. And so this is something where we're still learning more and more about it, but these nonprofits and coalitions, along with the federal government, are trying to bring more light to this so that more people come forward with their living history and their experience from these traumatic institutions.
And Will, as you said, I mean, we're looking at upwards of more than 150 institutions that were located just in the Mountain West.
Right. And again, I mean, the Mountain West is, I guess you could call it lucky in the sense that we do have a ton of Indigenous cultures that have remained strong throughout Idaho, throughout my home state of Wyoming, definitely in the Four Corners region. But with that comes this really hard history that I think residents of the Mountain West need to reckon with, because, you know, there are still people who remember being sent as a kid to a Christian missionary who then immediately cuts their hair, gives them a Anglo-Saxon name and tells them that you can't speak your language. I mean, that's a traumatic experience. And I learned about it a little bit in school, but I certainly didn't know the extent of it until I sort of started digging more into this for some of this reporting.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think you bring up a good point, Will, that so many of us never learned about this at all, right? Until this has started to come to light. I mean, there was one in my hometown in Washington State as well that closed in 1920. So this has far-reaching effects for so many people. And I think that there's also that generational trauma that can also impact. So just appreciate this reporting that you did on this so more of us are aware of it.
Yeah, thank you.
So Caitlin, let's just switch gears completely. So a big project going on over in Eastern Idaho, and this has to do with the Civic Center in Idaho Falls. Tell us about this, because we're talking, what, upwards of a $7 million renovation, a new name. So talk to us about that.
Yep. So this is a big project, and it's actually pretty exciting too, because this auditorium has been operating since 1952. It's connected to Idaho Falls High School. And basically, this week, the city of Idaho Falls announced that they are getting a new name, and there are plans to expand the lobby and renovate the Civic Center, the lobby, and the inside for generations of performing arts students to come, which is super exciting. So the new name for the Civic Center is going to be the Frontier Center for the Performing Arts, due to a $3.5 million donation from Frontier Credit Union here in Idaho Falls, which was formerly known as Eastern Idaho Credit Union. So they actually had their start here. This is where Frontier Credit Union began, and the city is really, really excited about it. So basically, this new name and the development has come because since 1952, when this auditorium opened, we've seen a 100,000 plus increase in residents of Bonneville County. So it's just growing exponentially. And they've been doing this in phases, basically. So phase one of this project began in 2019, where they decided to replace the seats and the carpets, repaint, add a lighting dimmer system in the auditorium, sound shells, a hydraulic orchestra pit lip, stuff like that. And they were able to kind of finish that. So now they're working on adding 27 ADA compliant restroom stalls underneath the lobby. They're working on adding a grand staircase and an elevator to be able to get to those bathrooms. And they're planning on tripling the size of the lobby. So the entire project will be about $7.4 million. And they're already two thirds of the way there. So they're just looking for that last little third to be able to finish all of these renovations and expansions. And I know for a fact, I'm really excited about it because this is kind of where a lot of the high school performing arts stuff goes on. So it's really exciting. It's a really great, it's going to be really great for all the students. And even if they don't go to IF, it's going to be really great.
So when are they hoping to have this entire project finished? Because as you said, they've been doing this in phases. So it's been going on for a while.
Right. So the expected finish date is fall 2026. So about 3 years is when they're hoping to have it completely done. But they did also say that they're going to try to keep it open and usable during construction, since most of it is just at this point for the lobby. So there'll be some workarounds going on, but for the most part, it's going to remain open from my understanding.
Well, I want to thank all of you for taking time out of your day to come talk to us and get us updated on so much that was happening this week. A big thank you to Caitlin Hart with East Idaho Ed News, with EastIdahoNews.com, Carly Flandreau with Idaho Ed News, and Will Walkie with the Mountain West News Bureau. Thank you all so much. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Thank you. You too.
Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
Black perspectives haven't always been centered in the telling of America's story. Now, we're taking center stage. Introducing NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, a collection of Black-led stories from NPR's podcasts. Search NPR Black Stories, Black Truths wherever you get your podcasts.